Good evening and welcome. This is the Christian Science Monitor for Thursday, June 5th, 2025. My name is Greg Riddell for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today's intro is by Clayton Collins, Director of Editorial Innovation for the Monitor. Scott Peterson has reported from Iran on 45 visits and written a book on the Islamic Republic. That immersion informs his work. Scott's story today blows past the theatrics of the United States' tense relationship with Iran. All-cap social media posts in one direction, death to America fist-pumping in the other, to focus on what matters, that only through engagement can two parties set about working for what they want, while seeking to accommodate what the other needs, and an understanding that such engagement may require shifts in thought. We'll begin with news briefs. President Trump announced a new travel ban. The administration is barring people from countries it deems dangerous, including Afghanistan, Myanmar, Chad, the Republic of Congo, Equatorial Guinea, Eritrea, Haiti, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen. The president's first travel ban was issued in 2017 and affected citizens of seven predominantly Muslim countries. The new ban goes into effect on Monday. Food aid was suspended in Gaza. The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation made the decision after health officials said dozens of Palestinians were killed in a series of shootings near its three sites this week. The group said it was in discussions with the Israeli military on increasing safety. The United Nations says the new system violates humanitarian principles. Also on Wednesday, the U.S. vetoed a UN Security Council resolution demanding an immediate and permanent ceasefire in Gaza because it was not linked to the release of hostages, saying it would embolden Hamas militants. All other 14 members of the council voted in favor of the resolution, which described the humanitarian situation in Gaza as catastrophic and called on Israel to lift all restrictions on the delivery of aid. The U.S. skipped a meeting of Ukraine's Western backers. Ukraine's president on Wednesday urged the group of around 50 countries to speed deliveries of air defense systems to counter Russian missile strikes and help boost weapons production. U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth did not attend. First time a Pentagon chief was not in attendance since the forum was set up 3 years ago. The U.K. and Germany chaired the meeting. A Guatemalan man deported to Mexico was returned to the U.S. President Trump's administration brought the man back to the U.S. after a court ordered facilitation of his return. His lawyers say that after landing in California, he was taken into custody and was being transported to a detention facility in Arizona. The man, who is gay, was protected from being returned to his home country under a U.S. immigration judge's order at the time. Vietnam abolished its long-standing two-child limit. The country aims to reverse declining birth rates and ease the pressure of an aging population on its developing economy with the legislation passed Tuesday. The birth rate in 2021 was 2.11 children per woman, just over the replacement rate required for a population to avoid shrinking over the long term. Since then, the birth rate has steadily declined. Bulgaria is set to adopt the euro. The European Commission on Wednesday gave the country the green light to join the eurozone next year. The approval could mean more foreign tourists and investment for the European Union's poorest country. Still, widespread corruption, stark income inequality, and a four-year political crisis have eroded trust in authorities, and many worry about a rise in prices during the switch. Now on to the first story. Lee won South Korea elections, but concerns over his integrity narrowed the race. Lee Jae-myung's victory in South Korea's presidential election on June 3rd fills a leadership void that was hobbling Asia's fourth largest economy. It heralds a liberal shift in South Korea's domestic agenda and efforts by Seoul, a key U.S. ally, to ease tensions with China and North Korea. But while voicing relief over a return to relative normalcy, after unrest over the martial law debacle involving its previous leader, some voters and analysts worry that more institutional reform is needed, and about the concentration of power under Mr. Lee, whose party now holds the presidency and a supermajority in parliament. By Ann Scott Tyson, reporting from Seoul, South Korea. 6 months after South Korea's conservative leader shocked the nation by declaring martial law, voters turned out in record numbers to elect his replacement. The left-leaning opposition party candidate, Lee Jae-myung, was immediately sworn in as president on Wednesday after winning 49% of the June 3rd vote and defeating the People Power Party, the PPP candidate, Kim Moon-soo, who won 41%. Voter turnout was nearly 80%, the highest in 28 years. Mr. Lee's victory fills a leadership void that has hobbled Asia's fourth largest economy. It comes at a time when South Korea is grappling with high tariffs from Washington and an abrupt downturn in economic growth caused in part by the political unrest. In his victory speech early Wednesday, Mr. Lee pledged to restore democracy to South Korea. "My first mission," he told thousands of supporters gathered near the National Assembly in Yeouido, "is to end the insurrection and prevent any further military coups." The martial law debacle undercut South Koreans' faith in former President Yoon Suk-yeol and the PPP, helping propel Mr. Lee of the center-left Democratic Party of Korea, the DPK, into office. But while voicing relief over a return to relative normalcy, some voters, as well as analysts, worry that South Korea's democracy remains vulnerable to political polarization and needs institutional reform. Some expressed fears about the concentration of political power, with Mr. Lee's party now holding the presidency and a supermajority in the National Assembly, South Korea's parliament. Koo Min-gyo, a professor at Seoul National University's Graduate School of Public Administration, expects Mr. Lee to use his party's sway over the different branches of government to extend his power while diminishing and stifling his critics. "That is going to be a nightmare," he says. "Without a healthy check and balance system, we cannot expect a healthy democracy." "It's true that revenge is a feature of South Korean politics," says Myung-hee Lee, assistant professor at the James Madison College of Michigan State University. "There is a vicious cycle of retaliation by incoming administrations," says Dr. Lee, who is in South Korea doing field research. But, she says, Mr. Lee has stated he would not pursue his opponents. "I hope he keeps his word," she says. Lee's character flaws. While his victory heralds a liberal shift in South Korea's domestic agenda, Lee Jae-myung is not ideological, says Mr. Koo. "He is very pragmatic and practical, but he is very hungry for power." Indeed, questions about Mr. Lee's character are one reason Mr. Kim, a last-minute PPP candidate, was able to close a double-digit polling gap with Mr. Lee, long the front-runner in the presidential race. While some voters praised Mr. Lee as an experienced leader and embraced his progressive agenda, even his supporters raised concerns about the multiple criminal proceedings he faces on charges of corruption, misuse of public funds, and election law violations. Right now, we need a strong leader, even though he has character flaws, says Kyung Suk Choi, serving pork and kimchi stuffed dumplings at her family restaurant at Seoul's Mangwon Market. In contrast, many voters said they trusted the integrity of Mr. Kim, a former labor activist turned conservative union critic who served as labor minister under Mr. Yoon. Kim didn't take any bribes. He's clean, says Park Jong-pil, owner of a security business in the southern coastal city of Busan. He was always on the side of the weak people, the common people, he adds, walking on Busan's Hyundai beach, restoring faith in South Korea's economy. A major common concern of South Korean voters is the nation's slowing economy, which is projected to grow only 1% this year, according to a new forecast this week by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. The OECD has twice downgraded its projection for South Korea this year, citing fallout from the political unrest and global trade tensions. All these small business owners in South Korea are suffering now, but they, those in government, aren't doing anything about it, says Michael Park, a self-employed taxi driver whose disillusionment with politicians led him to sit out the election. The rich class is getting richer, says Mr. Park, adding that half his income goes to pay for tutoring and taekwondo classes for his two school-age sons. Kim Sun-yui, a painter living in a quiet back street of Seoul's Yongdeungpo district, says her biggest concern is that three of her four children can't find permanent work and live at home. Young people can't get jobs these days, she says. But the voters differed on how to remedy South Korea's economic ills. Some favored Mr. Lee's populist, pro-labor, and welfare policies, but many opposed his plans to raise taxes on business and redistribute income. That will ruin the Korean economy, says Yung Ji-young, who owns a small online clothing business. Despite such disagreements, a reflection of the country's deep polarization, many South Koreans are simply thankful to put the instability of the martial law episode behind them. The past 6 months prove that Korean democracy is resilient, says Mr. Park, the security business owner. Going forward, it will be much smoother. Next story. Trump's pivot to Asia is a turn away from Europe. Donald Trump makes the Indo-Pacific the U.S. military's top priority in his America First foreign policy, but Asian allies are unsettled by Washington's tariff war. By Ned Temko, London. The full scale of Donald Trump's ambition to remake U.S. foreign policy and redefine America's approach to the world has become clearer in the past few days with the rollout of his version of an Obama-era initiative dubbed the Pivot to Asia. It builds on one of the few remaining areas of bipartisan consensus in Washington, countering the rising economic clout, military strength, and geopolitical ambitions of China. But Mr. Trump's approach could hardly be more different than the shift begun under Mr. Obama and expanded by President Joe Biden. President Trump's bet is that it will also be more effective, a show of power that will ultimately allow for creative deal-making with Chinese President Xi Jinping. It is designed to ensure, as Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth told a major Asian security conference last Saturday, that China will not invade Taiwan on his, Mr. Trump's, watch. But he will have to reckon with two imponderables. How will Mr. Xi respond? At least initially, China's pushback on Mr. Hegseth's address has been scalding. And what of America's Asian allies, described by Mr. Hegseth as key force multipliers? They are feeling conflicted, confused, and unsettled about Mr. Trump's America these days, and not only because of his sudden announcement in April of sweeping tariffs on their exports to the United States. They are front-row spectators in Mr. Trump's on-and-off tariff war with China, a key trading partner for many of them, and they are worried by the prospect of being caught in the middle of a major superpowers showdown. They've also been watching Mr. Trump loosen his commitment to the countries that had been America's closest allies since World War II, the NATO member states of Europe. It is from Europe that the contrast between Mr. Trump's pivot and the Obama-era vision appears most stark. When then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton first set out the policy in a 2011 essay, she presented the pivot as building on, not downgrading, the transatlantic alliance. But under Mr. Trump, it has begun to look like a pivot away from the European allies. The president has suggested that America's security commitment to them could depend on whether he thinks that they have been spending enough on defense. He has also prioritized ending the Ukraine war over heeding European allies' warning that a peace deal should not reward Russian President Vladimir Putin for his 2022 invasion. That view is shared by America's major allies in Asia. They are concerned that such an outcome could embolden Mr. Xi to make good on his pledge to make the island democracy of Taiwan part of China, by force, if necessary. The encouraging news for the Trump administration is that Washington already has strong and expanding security partnerships with key Asian countries, including Japan and South Korea, Australia and New Zealand, the Philippines and Taiwan. The Biden administration also increased security cooperation with other major players, including India, and encouraged closer ties among regional partners. They share America's concerns about China's growing power and Beijing's increasing readiness to brandish it, especially in disputed areas of the South China Sea. And they view U.S. support as vital to their security. So they will have welcomed Mr. Hegseth's overall message that the Indo-Pacific was now the American military's priority theater. Ditto his insistence that Mr. Trump did not seek conflict with China, but a peace through strength that would make the costs too high for Beijing to dominate us or our allies and partners. But they were left in no doubt that their terms of engagement with Washington and of any new peace arrangement with Beijing would be set by Mr. Trump. President Trump was elected to apply America first on the world stage, Mr. Hegseth declared. We ask and indeed insist that our allies and partners do their part, he added, telling them that they can and should quickly upgrade their own defenses. Echoing what he called the administration's tough love approach in NATO, he called on Asian allies to ratchet up their defense spending to 5% of GDP. That is clearly out of early realistic reach, even in those countries already increasing their military outlays. South Korea, for example, facing a nuclear-armed North Korea, spends less than 3% of its GDP on defense. Mr. Hegseth's message had particular force because Mr. Trump has in the past openly questioned the cost of American military support for South Korea, Japan, and Taiwan. He has also suggested Taiwan had stolen the role of preeminent producer of advanced microchips from U.S. companies. Still, Washington's Asian allies can hope that strongly shared security interests and Mr. Trump's determination to achieve peace through strength with China will shield them from the kind of tensions shaking the transatlantic partnership. On the other hand, amid Mr. Hegseth's praise for his boss's guiding worldview that America does not have or seek permanent enemies, NATO's experience has left some of them wondering whether, under Mr. Trump, America can be relied on as a permanent friend. You're listening to the Christian Science Monitor on Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of reading from over 200 publications. Next story. Maori lawmakers performed haka in the New Zealand Parliament. Now, they are suspended. New Zealand legislators suspended three Maori lawmakers on June 5th after they performed a haka, a chanting dance of challenge. The lawmakers aimed to protect a bill that could endanger indigenous rights. By Charlotte Graham McClay, Wellington, New Zealand. New Zealand legislators voted Thursday to enact record suspensions from Parliament for three lawmakers who performed a Maori haka to protest a proposed law. Hana Rawiti Maipi Clark received a 7-day ban, and the leaders of her political party, Debbie Ngarwewa Packer and Rawiri Waititi, were barred for 21 days. 3 days had been the longest ban for a lawmaker from New Zealand's parliament before. The lawmakers from Te Pāti Māori, the Māori party, performed the haka, a chanting dance of challenge, in November to oppose a widely unpopular bill, now defeated, that they said would reverse indigenous rights. The protest drew global headlines and provoked months of fraught debate among lawmakers about what the consequences for the lawmakers' actions should be, and the place of Maori culture in Parliament. Why the punishment was so strict? A committee of the lawmakers' peers in April recommended the lengthy bans. It said the lawmakers were not being punished for the haka, but for striding across the floor of the debating chamber toward their opponents while doing it. Judith Collins, the committee chair, said the lawmakers' behavior was egregious, disruptive, and potentially intimidating. Ms. Maipi Clark rejected that description Thursday, citing other instances when legislators have left their seats and approached opponents without sanction. The suspended legislators said they are being treated more harshly than others because they are Maori. I came into this house to give a voice to the voiceless. Is that the real issue here? Ms. Maipi Clark asked Parliament. Is that the real intimidation here? Are our voices too loud for this house? Why this haka was controversial. Inside and outside Parliament, the haka has increasingly been welcomed as an important part of New Zealand life. The sacred chant can be a challenge to the viewer, but it is not violent. As Maori language and culture have become part of mainstream New Zealand in recent years, haka appear in a range of cultural, somber, and celebratory settings. They have also rung out in Parliament to welcome the passage of high-profile laws. Some who decried the protest haka in Parliament cited its timing, with Ms. Maipi Clark beginning the chant as votes were being tallied and causing a brief suspension of proceedings. She has privately apologized for the disruption to Parliament's Speaker, she said Thursday. A few lawmakers urged their peers to consider rewriting rules about what lawmakers could do in Parliament to recognize Maori cultural protocols as accepted forms of protest. One cited changes to allow breastfeeding in the debating chamber as evidence that the institution had amended its rules before. Who approved the suspensions? Normally, the parliamentary committee that decides on punishments for errant lawmakers is in agreement on what should happen to them, but panel members were sharply divided over the haka protest, and the lengthy punishments were advanced only because the government had more legislators in parliament than the opposition. One party in the government bloc wanted even longer suspensions and had asked the committee if the Maori Party lawmakers could be jailed. Most in opposition rejected any punishment beyond the one-day ban Ms. Maipi Clark already served. Speaker Jerry Brownlee urged lawmakers last month to negotiate a consensus and ordered a free-ranging debate that would continue until all agreed to put the sanctions to a vote. But no such accord was reached. After hours of occasionally emotional speeches in which opposition lawmakers accused the government of undermining democracy by passing such a severe punishment on its opponents. While the bans were certain to pass, even as the debate began Thursday, it remained unclear whether opposition lawmakers would filibuster to prevent the suspensions from reaching a vote. By evening, with no one's mind changed, all lawmakers agreed the debate should end. Every government lawmaker voted for the punishments, while all opposition members voted against them. The law that prompted the protest. Thursday's debate capped a fraught episode for race relations in New Zealand, beginning with the controversial bill that the Maori Party lawmakers opposed. The measures would have rewritten principles in the country's founding document, a treaty between Maori tribal leaders and representatives of the British Crown, signed at the time New Zealand was colonized. The bill's authors were chagrined by moves from Parliament and the courts in recent decades to enshrine the Treaty of Waitangi's promises. Opponents warned of a constitutional crisis if the law was passed, and tens of thousands of people marched to Parliament last November to oppose it. Despite growing recognition for the treaty, Maori remained disadvantaged on most social and economic metrics compared to non-Maori New Zealanders. Next story. Trump revives a travel ban. Could it be legal this time? President Trump's new travel ban draws on lessons from his first term. He cites national security justification for the restrictions, while critics point to legal and moral problems. By Henry Gass. Revisiting a landmark policy from his first term, President Donald Trump issued a proclamation Wednesday night restricting the ability of nationals from 19 countries to enter the United States. The move echoes the travel ban referred to by critics as a Muslim ban Mr. Trump ordered in 2017. The proclamation issued this week, while different in notable ways, purports to tackle the same broad policy goal, addressing national security concerns by restricting the ability of individuals from specific countries to enter the U.S. After federal courts struck down two iterations of Mr. Trump's initial travel ban, the U.S. Supreme Court ultimately upheld it. This new proclamation targets many of the same countries and critics say it carries many of the same legal and moral flaws. Nevertheless, it appears to be on stronger legal footing and further reinforces the Trump administration's muscular approach to immigration enforcement. What does the proclamation do and why? According to a White House fact sheet, the proclamation is intended to protect the nation from foreign terrorist and other national security and public safety threats from entry into the United States. The proclamation goes into effect on Monday. It fully restricts and limits the entry of nationals from 12 countries, Afghanistan, Chad, Republic of Congo, Equatorial Guinea, Eritrea, Haiti, Iran, Libya, Myanmar, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen. Citizens of 7 other countries will face partial restrictions on their entry to the U.S. Burundi, Cuba, Laos, Sierra Leone, Togo, Turkmenistan, and Venezuela. The proclamation includes some exemptions, such as legal permanent residents, certain visa categories, and athletes. The fact sheet says the proclamation comes after national security agencies engaged in a robust assessment of the risk that countries posed to the United States, including regarding terrorism and national security. Countries have been targeted with restrictions because of inadequate screening and vetting processes, high visa overstay rates, and a history of not accepting their deported citizens back, and for having a significant terrorist presence or state-sponsored terrorism, according to the White House. How does it compare to the first travel ban? The legal authority for the proclamation is Section 212F of the Immigration and Nationality Act, the INA, which allows the president to place entry restrictions on any class of immigrants whose entry would be detrimental to the interests of the United States. The Supreme Court has regularly ruled that courts should defer to the executive branch on matters of immigration enforcement and national security. The High Court did so in a 2018 decision upholding Mr. Trump's first term travel ban. Section 212F exudes deference to the president, wrote Chief Justice John Roberts in the majority opinion. That travel ban, the majority held, also did not violate the Constitution's prohibition on the establishment of a single religion. It took the first Trump administration 3 tries to reach that point, however. Federal courts struck down earlier versions of that ban on the grounds that it violated the INA and unconstitutionally discriminated against Muslims. During his 2016 presidential campaign, Mr. Trump had promised a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States. The proclamation issued this week looks more like the third iteration of the first travel ban. The proclamation offers clear, country-by-country justifications pertaining to national security concerns and immigration law violations. Not all the countries included are majority Muslim. What is less clear is why certain countries have not been included. 4 countries targeted by the 2017 ban, Iraq, Nigeria, North Korea, and Syria, will not be affected by this week's proclamation. Syria has been designated by the U.S. as a state supporter of terrorism since 1979, and is now led by Ahmed al-Shara, a former rebel commander with ties to al-Qaeda. Mr. Trump has sought to thaw relations between the two countries in the past month, however. Egypt also is not included, though Mr. Trump said a recent anti-Semitic attack by an Egyptian in the U.S. on an expired visa underscored the dangers posed by visa overstays. Some countries with relatively high visa overstay rates, such as Angola, Djibouti, and Liberia, are also included. What concerns are there about the proclamation? The proclamation is almost certain to face legal challenges. For one, it could face a constitutional challenge, like the first travel ban did. The INA is clear that there must not be discrimination based on national origin in determining who is allowed to enter the United States, says Ilora Mukherjee, director of Columbia Law School's Immigrants' Rights Clinic. This new proclamation is very clear that there will be blatant discrimination based on national origin. Opponents have also said that the Trump administration is overstating the severity of its national security and immigration law concerns. From 1975 to 2024, one person from one of the 19 targeted countries committed a terrorist attack on U.S. soil, according to Alex Nauriste, an immigration law expert at the Cato Institute. The threat of foreign-born terrorism and crime is manageable and small, especially from the countries facing new bans and restrictions by the administration, he wrote in a blog post. Experts also dispute the Trump administration's visa overstay statistics. The administration relies on a fiscal year 2023 report from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security on visa overstays in justifying why certain countries are targeted by the proclamation. For instance, nearly 52% of students and exchange visa holders from Chad overstayed their visa, as did 49% of that country's business and tourist visa holders, according to the document. Some experts have said for years that those government reports are not reliable estimates for visa overstays. Earlier versions of the reports include both actual overstays and unrecorded departures, one 2017 analysis concluded. A former senior immigration official told Forbes in 2017 that there's too much guesswork built into the reports. The proclamation this week could also cause troubling collateral damage, critics predict. Athletes will be exempt from travel restrictions, important since the U.S. will host the Soccer World Cup in 2026 and the Olympic Games in 2028. But fans from their countries will, presumably, not be able to travel to support them. Critics have said the proclamation casts doubt on whether spouses of family visa holders would be banned or not. An exemption is provided for holders of immediate family visas with clear and convincing evidence of identity and family relationship, in other words, DNA. Much about how the proclamation will be enforced remains unclear, with lawsuits likely to reach federal courts in advance of the proclamation taking effect next week. The Trump administration will be expected to have answers. Next story. What's behind Trump's assault on Harvard and crown jewel U.S. universities? Decades-long suspicion of elite universities has evolved under President Donald Trump into a full-scale war, punctuated this week by curbs on the flow of international students to Harvard by Simon Montlake, Cambridge, Massachusetts. The escalating battle between President Donald Trump and Harvard University is a high-stakes cultural and political standoff that echoes far beyond higher education. Public deference toward the scholarly excellence that Harvard represents has been eroded by a backlash against elite universities now seen by many voters as bastions of political liberalism. This growing resentment, mostly on the political right, has fueled an assault on their exalted status. It's a battle that has been years in the making. Conservatives have long seethed at the ideological tilt on most college campuses and accused administrators of stifling free speech. But it took the re-election of Mr. Trump, a businessman who started his own failed eponymous university and is finally attuned to status and slights, to light the fuse. New actions this week expand what amounts to a multi-pronged assault on elite universities. On Wednesday, the Department of Education asked for a review of Columbia University's accreditation status, citing anti-Semitism on its campus. That evening, President Trump issued a proclamation suspending visas for new foreign students at Harvard for national security reasons. Asked recently in the Oval Office about the dispute with Harvard, Mr. Trump blamed the university for being defiant. "Harvard has got to behave themselves," he said. "Harvard is treating our country with great disrespect, and all they're doing is getting in deeper and deeper and deeper. They've got to behave themselves." The Trump administration has already slashed federal funding of scientific and medical research, of which Harvard is a major recipient. In February, it began investigating 10 universities, all in Democrat-run states, accused of failing to protect Jewish students during a wave of campus protests over Israel's war in Gaza following the October 7, 2023 attack by Hamas. Columbia bowed under pressure. Other universities sought to reach agreements to unlock federal funds, but Harvard balked at the maximalist demands of the White House. Now it finds itself squeezed from all sides. In addition to the billions of dollars in frozen grants and federal contracts, and the administration's repeated efforts to block the enrollment of international students, Wednesday's proclamation came after an earlier effort was halted by a federal judge. Mr. Trump has also threatened to revoke Harvard's tax-exempt status, which would impact donations. The spending bill, passed recently by Republicans in the House of Representatives, would hike the 1.4% tax on Harvard's $53 billion endowment to 21%, adding to the financial and political pressure on the university. If you want to make an example and to demonstrate your power, how better to do it than to go after the university that's at the top of the heap? Asks Brian Rosenberg, a former president of McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota, who now teaches at Harvard's Graduate School of Education. It sends a chilling message. A dispute years in the making. As far back as 1951, when William F. Buckley Jr. penned his book, God and Man at Yale, colleges were catching conservative criticism for diverging from traditional values. But the relationship between GOP leaders and elite universities grew far more hostile during the past decade, as universities became more explicitly political in their messaging, often in direct opposition to Mr. Trump and his movement. In 2019, Mr. Trump signed an executive order that sought to condition federal grants and other funding for colleges and universities on their protection of free speech. President Joe Biden partly rescinded the directive in 2023. In a 2021 speech, J.D. Vance called universities the enemy. Notably, Mr. Trump, Vice President Vance, and Harmeet Dhillon, the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, all graduated from Ivy League schools. GOP Representative Elise Stefanik, whose aggressive questioning of university presidents at a 2023 congressional hearing on anti-Semitism helped launch the current conflagration, is a Harvard grad. Polling suggests the public has mixed views on the current fight. In a recent AP-NORC poll, 56% of U.S. adults said they disapprove of Mr. Trump's handling of college issues. Among Republicans, however, 83% expressed approval. A At the same time, the public perception of universities overall has grown far more negative, with the percentage of Americans saying they have a great deal of confidence in higher education falling from nearly 60% in 2015 to just 36% in 2024, according to Gallup. This shift reflects rising concerns about the affordability and efficacy of a college education, as well as the political climate on campuses. Now, this battle threatens to permanently weaken institutions once revered as crown jewels in an American economy that runs on talent and advanced research. Harvard has frozen hiring, cut spending, and hunkered down for what both sides agree could be a drawn-out dispute. Its vaunted research capabilities, which attract global talent and spin off commercial ventures, are most at risk, particularly if overseas researchers fear being denied visas. No one thinks the United States' oldest university, founded in 1636 and named after a Puritan minister who was its first major donor, will go out of business, but its ambitions, prestige, and influence could start to diminish, even as classes of graduates continue to don gowns in Harvard Yard. That prospect would delight cultural warriors of Mr. Trump's policy circles, who want to leverage government power over liberal-coded institutions and bring them to heel. The universities seem all-powerful, and they have acted as if they were all-powerful, and we're finally revealing that we can hit that where it hurts, Christopher Rufo, a conservative education activist, told the New York Times in April. Initial efforts to calm the waters. Harvard President Alan Garber took office amid a firestorm after the resignation of Claudine Gay, who had been taken to task in December of 2023 by Republicans in Congress over hate speech at Israel-Hamas war protests, and then accused of plagiarism. Initially, Dr. Garber had worked to repair relations in Washington. Harvard hired Republican lobbyists and sought to cooperate with Mr. Trump's anti-Semitism task force. Harvard removed faculty members from its Center for Middle Eastern Studies, which was enmeshed in controversy, and indicated an openness to making other reforms. Dr. Garber revised the university's definition of anti-Semitism and compiled and published evidence of harassment of both Jews and Muslims on campus. Analysts say Harvard sought to get ahead of a formal Title VI investigation under the Civil Rights Act by telegraphing that it had erred and would make amends while defending its academic freedom and autonomy. That strategy unraveled in April after the Trump administration sent a letter with an expansive list of demands for federal oversight of the university's hiring, admissions, student discipline, and other core functions. It also demanded greater viewpoint diversity, more conservatives on campus, and the derecognition of pro-Palestinian student groups. Backed by Harvard's governing body, Dr. Garber rebutted the demands as government interference that Harvard could not accept. After the White House retaliated by pulling $2.2 billion in federal funding, the university sued. The New York Times later reported that the April 11th letter of demands may have been sent in error by the White House. Dr. Garber told the Harvard Crimson that the university faced a very stark situation under the demands. We saw ourselves as being given the choice of standing up for fundamental rights of universities, including First Amendment rights, or letting this demand go by, he said. When you think of it in those terms, there really was no choice. As the Monitor recently reported, the university has been buoyed by public support for its stance, including from other universities and from Harvard alumni, who include influential and deep-pocketed allies. Some Harvard professors have pledged to donate part of their salary to the university. Dr. Garber has done the same. "Everyone is looking at austerity," says a staffer at Harvard Law School who didn't want to be named because of the sensitivity of the dispute. At this year's graduations, parents of students expressed far more pride than in past years in being connected to the school, the staffer says. "The message is that we know that you're in the trenches and we support you." Harvard has faced many crises in its history, including the 1950s Red Scare and campus uproar over the Vietnam War, says William Kirby, a Harvard historian and a former dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. He says this crisis ranks among them, since it pits the university against an administration pressing a full-throated attack with unreasonable and unlawful demands. There's absolutely no good faith on the part of those in the government pursuing this vendetta, he says. They're asking for things that would be impossible, I think, for any university to do and to maintain any semblance of its own values. A symbolic target. Harvard's defenders and critics agree on one thing. It's a big target, and if it can't stand up to the Trump administration, given its wealth and reach, then other universities are even less likely to prevail. In Chinese, this is known as killing the chicken to scare the monkey, notes Professor Kirby, who teaches China studies as well as business administration. Prosecutorial resources are finite, says Jay Green, a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank. Making an example of a high-profile target helps with enforcement of all the others. It's an efficient use of resources to correct wrongdoing. Harvard's resources are also finite. It became dependent on federal grants without hedging against the risk of a political backlash as it adopted increasingly liberal messaging, argues Dr. Green, a former professor of education policy at the University of Arkansas. This isn't really about autonomy. It's not really about competing visions of civil rights. It's really a fight over political interests, he says. He supports the Trump administration's demands of Harvard, with one exception: viewpoint diversity. That goal is correct and long overdue, says Dr. Green, but falling short on that isn't a violation of the Civil Rights Act. Still, he adds, it would be educationally good practice and politically smart for Harvard to diversify its faculty and student body by welcoming more conservatives. Mr. Trump isn't the first president to use civil rights law and the federal funding spigot to strong-arm universities. President Barack Obama used Title IX to change how universities treated students accused of sexual misconduct. That directive didn't impinge, however, on academic freedoms such as faculty hiring, admissions, and curriculums. Critics of Harvard say its defense of academic freedom is undermined by its own failure to uphold free speech and a pervasive culture of self-censorship among students. Surveys show that most students and faculty at Harvard identify as left or center-left. The university was ranked dead last in a 2025 survey measuring free speech on college campuses by Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. Academics who teach contentious topics at Harvard say that, properly managed, classroom debate flows freely, away from the spotlight of public protests and social media outrages. "We have no shortage of differences of opinion. This is a place of free and open inquiry," says Professor Kirby, who has led discussions on China-Taiwan relations, among other topics. "They know they can't resist forever. Mr. Trump recently suggested taking $3 billion from a very anti-Semitic Harvard and redistributing the money to vocational and technical schools. While that suggestion is at odds with the purpose behind scientific and other research grants, research that trade schools can't replicate, analysts say such attacks resonate with Mr. Trump's base that distrusts higher education. A more plausible scenario is that federal dollars will flow instead to institutions that aren't at odds with the administration, and that Harvard's research talent will follow suit. The university could tap wealthy donors to make up shortfalls for a while, but that is a stopgap measure at best. It also leaves Harvard open to other pressure points, including visa approvals for international students and scholars. The difficulties that can be made for Harvard are more than what Harvard can manage. On some level, I think they know that they can't resist forever, says Dr. Green. Professor Rosenberg agrees, even for an institution with this kind of wealth and reputation, this is going to be extremely difficult to navigate. I think if there were a reasonable exit ramp, Harvard would take a serious look at it. Harvard could opt to scale down its research labs, shrink its workforce, and focus more on undergraduate teaching and mid-career programs that generate income, but that would put it at a competitive disadvantage to peer institutions at home and abroad. The research talent that powers Harvard's long line of Nobel Prize winners and other markers of excellence may also look outside the U.S. At some point, some students who might have chosen Harvard in the past may think about going elsewhere. While the prestige of elite schools like Columbia and Harvard remains strong, the perception that they are awash in political activism has also filtered down, says Elizabeth Doe Stone, president of Top Tier Admissions, a college prep consultancy. Families that are not even conservative but are more politically moderate are thinking about their child's education and wanting it to be focused on having a typical college experience and not having the distractions of the political climate. For now, though, Harvard is still Harvard. The brand is incredibly resilient. What we'll find out in this next year is just how resilient, she says. That's it. You've been listening to the Christian Science Monitor for Thursday, June 5th, 2025. My name is Greg Riddell for Sutton Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for listening. Good night.